What is joy in our lives? What is the meaning of joy? What is our experience of joy? And what is the importance of joy in the practice? So when I say this word, joy, there's probably going to be a reaction for all of us related to our experience of ourselves in the world and our opinions about how we relate to the world. So for a lot of people, joy is a personality thing. It's, he's a joyful person, she's a joyful person, I'm a joyful person, I'm not a joyful person, I used to be a joyful person, I want to be a joyful person. It can be a label that we slap on. And we all have this potentiality for joy that we are born with, this deep potentiality for joy. But in a lot of us, it can get quite shut down and crusty and overlaid by all these experiences, opinions, and reactions to the world. So it's a good thing just to reflect in our hearts right now what comes up for us when the subject of joy comes up. Is it a natural relaxation into familiarity and love and something that's really grown through our lives if we're very fortunate in our conditioning? Or is it something that we hope for, struggle with, strive for, and have maybe an agenda with? Maybe joy is a goal in our practice. I wanted to speak a little bit about being shut out of joy by experience, because this can happen. The joys that we associate with the world, with worldly pleasures, are very coarse kind of joys, and they tend to come and go very quickly. So it's marginal as to whether we can really call them joys, that they're excitements that we can get, comforts that we can get through our contact with pleasure, maybe through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the thinking mind. So all of these can be used for these pleasures. But as we go further in our practice, we start to see the impermanence of these things and how they crumble. They crumble as we're experiencing them. They are crumbling so fast. And we're here this morning because we know they're not a safe refuge. It's not safe to depend on these things for our happiness. So I think we probably all have awareness of that fact. So if we are practicing, we are pulled towards these wisdom teachings, and we're aware that joy is thin on the ground or quite coarse, so not easy to find in a fine way, not easily accessible in our meditation practice, in our relationships with people. We can look at how the body experiences these coarser kinds of joy. Not through the senses, but through what comes up in our meditation practice. Deep bodily sensations, they can come through emotions, and they can be deeply buried. And in our meditation practice is a unexpected, perhaps, and hugely fruitful way of experimenting with these joys and opening up to them. So even as we're sitting now, just being aware of the value and the love of this practice and the beautiful intentions we all have to be together in Dhamma, in safety, perhaps there's some tingling in the body, some aliveness in the spine. a feeling of opening, maybe outwards, maybe upwards, but just a feeling of relaxing, even if the body can't relax. Just an experimentation with that. And this is our ventures into joy when the body has shut down, or when life is busy and things are tense. We hear news in the world, it's upsetting, distressing, and the body can move into these kind of iron-like, ironclad-like, crusty, stiff containers of solidified anger, fear, wanting. So we're here to study the impermanence of these. And in studying the impermanence of these apparently solid, apparently characteristic states, we get this opening into, this is not solid. This is not a character trait. It's merely a habit. It's continually moving on. And the practice is not to manhandle this habit by force into how I want to be, the person I want to be, the person I should be, the person I should have been, the person they want me to be, but simply to experience the reality of them in a safe environment, which is not the same as thinking about them. But it's just not pushing them away. So relaxing into the safety of one breath at a time, this experience can be experienced in a safe way. And this is developmental, this is cumulative. It may seem like a tiny drop in the ocean, but the tiny drops build up if we keep at it. In the practice, we're encouraged to move towards greater sila, sometimes called virtue, morality, being inwardly truthful with how we relate to the world. So probably people here are familiar with the five precepts. Some of you may be familiar with the eight precepts. And these are a way of aligning ourselves with what our hearts really wish for. So in a way, it's going back to that childhood innocence and guiding ourselves in ways that are wholesome and will allow body and mind to relax. And stretching our sila practice into practices of generosity are extremely useful, so we can all find areas of our lives where we can move into generosity towards those we love, those we care for, those who we find difficult, ultimately to all beings, dedicating our practice, our lives, and our energy that we have available to serving beings who are suffering, and dedicating towards those who are in danger, those who are sick, parents, creatures, all the animals in the world. And this does involve the thinking mind to a greater degree, particularly at the beginning. But these movements outward into the world and stretching our own potential for gratitude, for generosity, will move us a little further into the area of mudita, or empathetic joy, which is quite an extraordinary quality that humans have this privilege of being able to delve into. It's hard to know to what degree animals can do this, but the evidence may be that some of the higher animals may be able to. We just don't know. But what we do know is that humans can practice empathetic joy, which is joy in seeing somebody else or something else receive a blessing, receive love, receive care. Even if it's something we don't have ourselves, we wish for ourselves. We have this capacity to give our love in that way, which can really open the heart to joy. And we may all have heard stories of people who were starving to death who sincerely give their last crust of food to someone else who is starving in a joyful way, which if we've experienced significant hunger, then we will understand the power of that. That is an extraordinary move into the arena of love and selflessness. So strangely, renunciation, which sounds so grim to a lot of people, renunciation sounds like giving up what is pleasurable, what maybe we feel we need. We all know areas in our lives where we lean on things more than we should. We have little crutches. They may be benign, they may be less benign. It's really, really good to own up to these and not pretend to ourselves. And it's also really good not to expect too much of ourselves, but simply opening up to the truth that certain things are not helpful, but they're very hard to give up, and focusing on the pain that that brings us, because ultimately that does bring us pain. Anything that isn't aligning us to the truth in our hearts and the truth of reality, brings us pain. So we have this inner compass that's constantly moving us towards truth and joy if we let it. And the letting it can involve going against some of the strong pushes in the world and our feelings of wanting to escape very painful things. And it can be very hard not to want to escape, distract, and get away from the truth of suffering. We practice learning to be with things when conditions are relatively favorable. And this gets us on our feet so that we can learn to be with things when conditions are less favorable, or even when conditions are very difficult indeed. If we get very sick, if we're dying, we need a practice that's a true resort, a true refuge. And we train our minds towards this. It isn't just something we can think about at the last minute. We train our minds starting now, when things are fairly straightforward. Even if the mind is quite turbulent, we know the mind is turbulent. And that changes everything. Again, it may seem like a little thing, but it's not. We balance on that knowledge that things are difficult right now, or not. We balance on the present moment. If we practice balancing, we can get really good at it. I remember years ago, I saw a movie when I was a laywoman that made a deep impression on me about a man who stretched with a lot of help when the Twin Towers were up. They stretched a wire between the towers and he walked the wire, and it was windy. He trained and trained and trained to do this. He was a French man. And the guards on the buildings were very upset because this was totally illegal thing to do. So there were guards on each end of the wire trying to catch him. And he was remembering it afterwards. And he said he was actually running along the wire to escape the guards. And the wind was blowing the wire across this big distance. Even to think about it makes me feel quite strange because of the height. It was an extraordinary thing to see. And what made it possible was the training, not just of his body, but of his mind. Because if he had awoken to the desperate danger he was in, he would have fallen. But he stayed in a safe spot of balance. And that is our job, because if we are identified with these bodies, if I am identified with my body, then I am in desperate danger. But I do have a still point of safety, which is being here right now in this present moment. And as we study the present moment gently and faithfully in our practice through difficult times and joyful, easy times, we will discover the joy of balance and refine that joy. And the present moment will be something we can appreciate one moment at a time. And when we're balanced on one mind moment, there is nothing to fear. And when there's nothing to fear, there is no story. There's no past and no future. And when there's no past and no future, there's no me and you and identification with the body. So, with our thinking minds, we can get very distressed and fear our ideas about not being a person. That inner voice that doesn't want to die because we fear not being a person, not being me. Because if I'm not me, I'll be nothing. And if I'm nothing, that's terrifying. That's what our thinking minds can be saying. And our job as meditators is to be courageous beyond these thoughts, to see through these thoughts, not by an act of mind violence, but by this patient knowing. In our practice, we can find meditative joy, which can be very pure and clear, and give us rest and peace and comfort. This is to be valued as a temporary phenomenon. After these moments of clarity in our practice, our minds can be more relaxed and open to learning, and we can have deep insights after them. But in themselves, they are not a waking up. So incorporating all that we learn in our practice and persisting, we refine our joy beyond a bodily experience into something that travels with us through access more and more to the present moment. The troubles and difficulties of the world will not disappear, but through this balance, we become less reactive and less likely to regress into historical emotions, mind states, and fears that can really overwhelm us sometimes. This will lighten as the practice develops. We'll be more likely to be able to see our habit patterns and stop at an earlier point as the Buddha says in a very powerful teaching, at the beginning, you can notice after you do something unskillful, that was unskillful. Then eventually we can notice while we're doing something unskillful, this is unskillful, this is not leading toward my happiness and the happiness of others. And eventually to catch things really early and to weaken the muscle that pushes us in that direction through habit. And so the renunciation of these mind habits, as well as the acting out of unskillful things that are not helpful for us, can bring a very relaxed, peaceful joy to the heart. This is inner safety. This is a deep gift to ourselves and actually to those around us too. The people around us will feel this. It may be subtle. We're not expecting a medal. We're not doing this for a result. We're doing it out of love and care. Trusting in this practice is like a beautiful circle. It encourages us to trust more and more, to trust our insights, to use our insights, and to bring them in more and more when life is difficult. So every day is filled with opportunities, even if we feel like our practice is really strong. It may feel strong for this part of the day, but what about this person who I find difficult and the body's getting tense and I notice my voice is sounding a bit strange? How can I be more loving here to myself and to the other person? And it may be that being more loving involves putting up really good boundaries. Relaxing helps us to see how to be with ease and care in the world. So I find it useful to ask myself through the day, what is the quality of my attention? So right now, what is the quality of your attention? How are we interacting with the present moment? Not judging, not, oh, I lost my mindfulness, I wasn't listening. That's not useful. If we lose our mindfulness, that's a little waking up to come back. Great, we're back. And then, what is the quality of attention? Are we holding the experience of what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, feel, and think in a loving way? Are we receiving and not reacting, not a knee-jerk reaction? How wide is our attention? Notice, shut down or open? Cool or heated? Judging or accepting? When we notice what's going on, we can get beyond these words. Like a sponge absorbing water, we can just let the present moment seep into us when the heart is ready. Little sips at a time. I want to finish by just reading a few verses from the Dhammapada, which is a Buddhist classic. Ah, so happily we live, without hate, among those with hate. Among people who hate, we live without hate. Ah, so happily we live, without misery, among those in misery. Among people in misery, we live without misery. Ah, so happily we live without ambition, among those with ambition. Among people who are ambitious, we live without ambition. Ah, so happily we live, we who have no attachments, we shall feast on joy, as do the radiant gods. By ambitious, the translation does not mean if you're training to be a nurse or a plumber or a doctor, whatever, that's a beautiful thing, but it's the craving for more. So I'm going to stop there, see if there's any questions.
Thinking about all beings and malicious people and animals, wondering about mosquitoes, for instance, I'd love some guidance about how to deal with other people's malice and perhaps with mine.
Thank you for the honesty in that question. The Buddha, until he was enlightened, had to deal with thoughts of cruelty. We're human beings here. The roots of these things are deep, and just to own up to them can be a big breakthrough in just being truthful with ourselves. It doesn't help to pretend they're not here. We have a new generation of mosquitoes here. We have these new guys. They're little, but they're pretty bad. They're pretty vicious. And our rule is that we can't kill them, which is quite a practice. So we make do with head nets. We use certain essential oil sprays. Like this one called catnip, which the mosquitoes seem to hate temporarily. And we have these little animal traps. So we catch them. And then sometimes we just get bitten. And it's a good practice. I find sometimes when I'm catching these little guys, if I don't use the animal trap, if I've been bitten and I'm in pain, or there's just a lot of mosquitoes around, I don't want to get bitten by a mosquito, and I'll use it a bit too fast and I might crush the little guy. And then I'll think, what was my mind state? I wasn't intending to kill it, but I wasn't being patient. I find that very useful reflection just on how the maliciousness can be very, very fine, can be really quite subtle. So we all have to have our own code around what we do with mosquitoes. I don't tend to see them as malicious. I see them as actually it's pretty impersonal what they're doing. They're just trying to fulfill their natural functions. And walking through the forest, occasionally there's a story that there's a cougar around or a big bear's been seen. Then one can notice fear coming up. It probably wouldn't be a very nice death to be eaten in that way, but the animal would do it because it was hungry. You know, there wouldn't be any personal there. Dealing with people, we practice. There are always going to be malicious people around. There always have been. It's not that long ago that our ancestors were cave people, you know, tribal, trying to wipe each other out. So these roots go very, very deep. Our nearest relatives, as far as I know, they're still saying our nearest genetic common ancestor is with a chimpanzee. And chimpanzees are quite aggressive. They wage war. They can also be deeply loving. So I think it's good. It humbles us to grow up and see that we are not these kind of pure Homo sapiens, wise super beings. We're just animals with this incredible potentiality. So the practice takes us into these areas. I can't get up in the morning and say, I am not going to feel anger because I'm perceiving somebody as malicious. I can't make myself not feel anger, fear for revenge, fear for control, all the natural things that can come up due to our conditioning. But our job as meditators is to watch these things. We watch them. We observe them. If we don't push them away, we don't feel guilty. If we feel guilty, we watch the guilt. This is our practice. This is why we practice. So I don't really want to say anything more than that, because I feel like it's been said. There's no magic solution, Norman. We can't change ourselves. We can't change the world. We can watch our urge to to control the world. I don't want that politician to do that. What comes up in this mind and this body when I hear that piece of news? That's where we start our practice.
I have a question about the scary things in life on a more mental state. So for example, I go to a movie, I'm waiting for my movie to start, and there's previews that are quite terrifying or horror related. I personally always stay away from that because it's unwholesome for me. But I also recognize that staying away from these areas is not really fully benefiting me in my day-to-day because I am just simply ignoring it or pushing it away. And so my question is there something that I can do in those moments that would be beneficial for me to maybe be less fearful in those more visual states that I am witnessing that just don't resonate with me?
Thank you for your question. When we watch our minds and practice, we're learning to watch our thought processes, see them come and go as impermanent. And as we practice, we see an opening into our thought processes. So we won't necessarily be aware that we're thinking even a lot of the time. And it's not until we've done quite a bit of practice, possibly, that we can see how much thinking is going on. And the good news is we don't need to sit and watch previews of horror movies or whatever it is, because we have our own horror movies going on inside. So my advice for anyone in training would be to not stimulate themselves any more than they are already. The average person is probably stimulated enough, if not too much, by the complexities and difficulties of just living a life in the modern world. If you sat me down in a theater like that, obviously I'm a nun, I would walk out, but it's because I'm a nun, but also because I know the damage that can be done to the mind through inserting thoughts and ideas. We're like sponges. We will absorb things around us. If people around us are upset, we'll absorb some of that to a greater or lesser degree. If there's a horror movie playing in front of us, then that's going to reinforce our own horror movie or a clip or whatever it is. So my strong advice would be to value yourself more than this, to value your training more than this, to care for your mind deeply, and to really look at what you're feeding your mind. And if you are going to these places because of the people who you associate with, then you might need to look at that and find some Kalyanamita, some good friends who don't need to do that kind of thing.
How would you relate that? Would it be a similar answer to other stimulants? Like say, if you're excited about math or art or the news of UFOs that are like wondrous or astronomy, you think that kind of excitement would also fall in line with? I'm wondering about other sort of excitements that maybe are creative. Thank you.
Good question. Everyone has to decide for themselves what happens to the mind when it's exposed to these things. Does the mind settle into a relaxed meditative state when maybe you're doing some artwork or when you start considering the vastness of the galaxy? The mind can really relax into awe. But on the other hand, too much detail, too many concepts, too much stimulation. So see, experiment, see what effect this has on the mind. Can you sit down and meditate after you've read some articles online about this? The mind like excited? What's the quality of your mind state, the quality of your attention after doing these things? And everyone is different. I find that for myself, I have to be quite careful what I expose myself to because I'm training in better conditions to cope for when I die. And that's going to be probably a pretty overwhelming experience. So if I feel like I'm going to practice doing something overwhelming, then you have to be your own judge of that. But for most people, it's so easy to lose mindfulness. You have to wait till your mindfulness is very strong before you go into these dangerous or challenging areas. Let's care for our minds here.